and then came back and spent some more time analysing it. And so the time out of clinical medicine in the hospital was 3 years. If I'd taken another year in the Antarctic, that would have been 4 years. And I think they felt that most doctors wouldn't be prepared to spend that amount of time out of the NHS, and so they wouldn't be able to get back into the NHS, and so they wouldn't be able to recruit people. So they just they let the doctor go for a year, which is well, you get the full experience of a year, but you don't get, you know, I think a lot of the people on the base felt that the doctor was a bit unnecessary. he was paid a lot more than they were, and they were only there for a year, and I think some people felt that was a bit unfair, if you like, but that was the way it was. And I felt, and I think the survey feel, that it's important to have a doctor there, because you know, if things do go wrong, you need someone to sort them out, and I think that's right. And I think most of the doctors give good value for money, if you like, because more often than not, as far as I'm aware, there are things that happen, people injure themselves or get sick, and it's important to have a doctor on the spot, really.
Is it important to have a doctor on each pot? Because if you are there, you can't be present everywhere.
On each base, you mean?
Yeah.
They have a doctor at Cygni because they do a lot of diving, and diving is likely to cause problems. They have a doctor at Halley because Halley is so isolated, it's right on the Antarctic continent, and they like to make sure that you know, it's completely isolated. The ship comes once a year, and they can only fly aeroplanes in for 3 or 4 months of the season in the summer, and then for the rest of the time you're isolated. So they like to have a doctor there. And they have a doctor at Rothera because that's the travelling base, and there's lots of flying, and they have people out in the field, so they like to have a doctor available for that. And when I was there, and I don't know what the situation is now, but when I was there, they had a specially trained nurse at Faraday, which was the other base, who was able to be in close radio contact with the doctors at the other bases if necessary, and we all had communications back to the medical base in Aberdeen, which is where the medical side of things was run from, so with a fax machine or a telephone we could get in contact with anybody that we needed to and get advice and things if necessary.
Which is a little different from the 1946 experience.
I'm sure it is, yes. I think one thing that it taught me was taught me a great deal about being independent, and gave me a lot of self-confidence about, you know, diagnosing things, treating things. It also gave me a lot of self-confidence in my general, you know, lifestyle and the way that, you know, you have to make up your own mind as to what's going on down there and what you're going to do. And I think it was a very good lesson in discipline, really, in that you know, it teaches you that you're important, but you're also vulnerable, and you're important to other people, and other people are important to you. And I think that's an important lesson to learn.
Which way does this lesson of discipline actualize?
Sorry, which?
Which way does it come across?
Well, I think it just means that you are better able to make decisions and weigh up what's what the argument is for the way that you want to do things. I don't know really.
Do you remember your first impression when you got there?
When I got to the Antarctic, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you see, I think one of the things that is difficult is that unlike arriving in a new place by arriving in a port, or unlike arriving at an airport in a new place, you arrive there on the ship, certainly on the way down to Halley, you arrive there on the ship via various different points. It sort of starts in the Falkland Islands, and then we went to South Georgia, and from there we went to Sydney Island, and then from Sydney right down into the Antarctic to arrive at Halley. And so everything sort of changes very gradually. You know, South Georgia is different from Sydney, and Sydney is different from Halley, and so each place is different. But I think that there was an amazing sense of sort of beauty and awe. It was a very awesome experience in that everything was so quiet and everything was so clean and white and bright, and it was just, yes, it was. I suppose I'll just have a look, see what, I mean, I might have written something here in my diary. We got down there in December. I must say that one of the things that was absolutely fascinating was going through the pack ice in the ship. That was something that was really awe-inspiring, just seeing the ship going through the miles and miles of this pack ice. Yes, we arrived after Christmas. So here, I'm getting quite excited as I reach my new home for a year. Hopefully Mobster Creek is going to be workable, at least early on, so relief won't be as arduous as it could be. Let's see, that's right. Arrived at Halley at 6 a.m, having seen the big oil drum. H. There's a big, there used to be, I don't know whether there still is, a huge H made up of oil drums all welded together up on the cliffs. And I suspect that that's fallen into the sea by now. But we saw that at about 3 a.m. and had a bit of sleep in between. And then all very exciting. Once the captain was up, a ladder was thrown over the bows as we nudged the ice, to let the lonely group of people on the ice come on board for their mail, and to let the mooring party off. The old Halley men came on board to read their mail, and then had breakfast. It was amazing to see how they looked at and ate fresh eggs, which they hadn't seen for a year. They ate them with great gusto. And then I went off and started doing things. But I do remember it being terribly exciting. Because it was just, you know, I knew here I was going to arrive at this fantastic place which I was looking forward to getting to, and there it was, this ice, all these ice cliffs and the sea ice and penguins and seals on the sea ice, and it was just, the whole thing was sort of unreal, if you like, and yet there I was actually there. Yeah, it was sort of, you know, it was something that I'd never seen anything like it before, and very few people have been there. It was, you know, it was a very great privilege to be able to go somewhere where so few people, relatively few people, have been and experienced what was going on.
You arrived at Christmas?
Yes, we did. Yes. Well, there's the... I've got the Bransfield Christmas menu. We arrived just after Christmas. We had Christmas Day, Christmas lunch. It doesn't seem like Christmas. I seem to remember what we did. Yes, here we stopped for lunch today. The captain just pushed the bows into a huge piece of sea ice to wedge us in, and they switched the engines off, and pushed the bows into a piece of ice to wedge us in, and we all enjoyed ourselves. It was great. Moving again after 3 p.m. and then full steam ahead in virtually open water. Much sleeping done, and I felt extremely bloated, having eaten far too much, or so it seemed. And then we actually arrived at Halley on the 27th of December. And then we had... How many days? 27th until... Until the 1st of January, anyway, we were doing relief. And... then on the 3rd of January we started, we were moving into a new base which hadn't been completely finished in the previous year, and there was still quite a lot of building work to be done. And so for the next month, I think it was, what day did the ship leave? We spent just getting the base ready and getting ready to close down the old base and move into the new base. And the ship left on must have left on 13th of February, so it was there for a month and a half, and we were just getting ready, finishing off the building of the base, so that all the scientific equipment could be moved from the old base, which was 10 miles away, to the new base. I don't know if have you spoken to anyone from Halley?
From the 60s.
From the 60s, right. So that must have been in Grillage Village. Has anyone mentioned Grillage Village? No, well, what? The base was originally built in 1957 in the International Geophysical Year, and it was just a hut. And after a year, the hut had been buried with snow. I mean, I might not have got the timings exactly right. And then they built another base. And because Halley is where it is, it tends to get buried with snow. And after about 10 years, the weight of the snow on top of the base just tends to crush the base, and it needs to be evacuated and rebuilt. And 1984 saw the opening of Halley 4, that was the fourth base at Halley, which was again an underground base. It was built on the surface, and then the snow builds up on top of it, and so we were evacuating Halley 3 because it was 60 feet under the surface of the ice, and basically had to, the weight of the ice had begun to completely crush it and destroy it, and so everything had to be moved out to the new base. And the new base had been built 10 miles away from the old base, so we had to close all the scientific research down and transfer it all to the new base. And so that needed to be done. So we did all that in that month and a half that the ship was there, erecting all the scientific aerials and digging tunnels to put the magnetic instruments in and all these sort of things that had to be done, as well as the building work that was still going on the base. So it was all terribly exciting, and that all took quite a lot of time and a lot of physical work. You know, it was very tiring too.
Fascinating, this building that sinks into the ice all the time.
Well, now they've in fact there was rather a lot of problems with the base that I moved into. Within a year, the building was moving with the pressure of the ice on it, and its design life was 10 years, and it lasted. Well, it did last 10 years actually, because they've only just moved into the new base. And this time they've built the base on stilts, and they raise it up above the surface of the snow, so that the snow can blow underneath it and not fall on top of it. There's not very much snowfall at Halley, but there's an accumulation from blizzards, from snow blown from other parts of the Antarctic, an accumulation of about a metre a year. So it's quite a lot of snow blowing about in a blizzard.
What kind of equipment did you have?
From what point of view?
Medical point of view.
Well, we had a very well-equipped surgery. All the drugs and medicines come down from Cambridge or from London. They're all renewed every year, so everything you pack into big aluminium packing cases and is sent out, and they send in a completely new set of new drugs and equipment, so nothing is ever out of date. They provided us with surgical packs that were pre-packed, so that they were all sterile, so we didn't have to worry about sterilising instruments and things if we needed to do an operation. There was an operating table, an anaesthetic machine. I moved into this new base, which had really quite a nice surgery, which had a room for a hospital bed, a hospital-type bed in it, although that was kept stored in a cupboard most of the time, which meant that I had quite a nice big room in which to work, do my research, and actually have a room that was my own. I was fortunate. Most people on the base had to share an office, but I had this nice big room that was mine. The backup was good. I mean, there was no problem with backup, and the equipment was good. Fortunately, I didn't have to use very much of it. We had an X-ray machine, which I did have to use, there was very little that I would have wanted. You know, other things that I'd wanted, and the survey was very good at allowing me or any of the doctors, if we wanted specific medicines to take down or specific instruments or specific drugs or whatever, they would provide a certain amount of things for our own use, if we were particularly skilled. For instance, I'd had experience in anaesthesia, and I wanted to take some special needles and things down in case I could have done a regional anaesthetic technique if necessary, rather than give someone a general anaesthetic. So there was lots of the equipment was no problem at all.
Amazing. Did you know this?
Did I know what?
That you could expect such a lot of equipment.
Oh yes, because prior to going down, we had a big we had a lot. We had some training before we went down, went up to Aberdeen and joined the Aberdeen Royal Infirmary Casualty Department. We went to the bacteriology department. We went to the dental department. I went to the Eastman Dental Hospital and got some experience in removing teeth and putting in local anaesthetic blocks for the dental work. Because although there was a dentist on the ship and he saw everybody who was going down and everybody who was on the base, so everyone got dental care during their stay, obviously the dentist wasn't there for 12 months, and so there was a possibility that someone would need dental treatment. So I went and learned how to take teeth out and things at Eastman. And yes, we had quite a good training beforehand, and we had everyone went on a first aid course. Everyone who went down to the Antarctic had been on a first aid course, so everyone had been trained in first aid, in resuscitation, and in what to do in certain difficulties, because a lot of people in the Antarctic are actually on their own for a lot of the time. They at Rothera, for instance, people are out in groups of two, completely alone out in the Antarctic, and should they fall down a crevasse and break an arm or whatever, then they've got to be able to treat each other. And there's a very good book called Curafid, which was written by one of the Bass doctors many years ago, and it's been updated, but that's a sort of modified first aid book which has got lots of instructions about what to do. And then everyone who's out in the Antarctic always has radio, is always in radio contact with their main base, and so there's always the possibility of talking to a doctor and getting advice, and then of course the doctor can either go out to see them or they can be brought back into the main base. The only thing that was a bit disconcerting was when we went on our holiday and went travelling. When I was the doctor, I was travelling with three other people on our expedition, and obviously I had to be in contact with the base every day. We all had to be in contact with the base every day anyway, but if anybody had got sick while I was away, it would have meant that I would have had to go back to base, which was would have been a bit sad, really, but there we are. Didn't happen, so that was fine.
I assume that the doctor has to look after the other people.
Sorry. On the base, yes.
Yeah. I mean, doctors usually look after people and yeah. They sort of keep track of things, so they have a sort of view.
Sorry, they have a
sort of view on people.
Yes, yeah, that's true.
You told me about your research on the pineal gland.
Yes.
Circadian rhythm. Apart from the experimental result, you probably had some observation on it.
Well, that's right. I was doing this research on the pineal gland and the hormone that it secretes, and it secretes the hormone in relation to the light-dark cycle. And that is something that people have thought ever since the first Antarctic explorers, that people tended to get depressed during the night, during the long Antarctic night. Where I was, we had 3 months of continual darkness. The sun didn't come above the horizon, and I was expecting people to be, in inverted commas, depressed, and I was looking for it. But actually being there, it's quite difficult because you're all involved with each other, and actually looking for it was quite difficult, and We didn't have anybody who was so depressed that they needed treatment, for instance. But generally, during the winter, during the long winter nights, people weren't as lively, people weren't as quite as enthusiastic as they were during the summer. And I put that down to the fact that, that there was no sunlight. And certainly, I did this research with some bright, very bright sunlight simulating lamps. And subjectively, those people that were in the bright light group as opposed to the control group felt better. I mean, I was just reading my diary the other day about this. I just happened to open it, and I can't find it at the moment, but it just said, one person. Here we are. Someone said this morning that he was a fan of the lights. Although he's not sleeping any longer time, he is convinced that the quality of his sleep is much better. Like me and someone else, he's blaming me for not being able to get up because he's sleeping better. Getting up this morning was like climbing out of a crevasse, he said. So, you know, I think people, a lot of people in the winter found it quite difficult to sleep. And there were three people who were in the bright light treatment group who actually said that they slept better because they were, you know, and they put it down to the fact that they were being exposed to some bright light. And certainly when the sun came back, the whole base was sort of joyful and enthusiastic. I wonder what day the sun did come back. Go to the next book. I don't know. I ought to be able to tell you when the sun came back, shouldn't I? Sorry?
It should come back.
Oh, it certainly did come. Certainly came back. I just can't remember which day it actually came back. It must have been before then. Sorry, are you running out of tape?
No.
June 27th, still feeling up and down, but more up than down, worried about people not getting enough light. They must have still been doing the experiment then. I actually haven't looked at this diary since I wrote it 10 years ago, and discovered from the base commander that our talk last Saturday, I can't remember what that was about, had been extremely useful to him because he hadn't realised the bitterness and antagonism that was rife amongst some base members. I must admit that I thought he didn't realise. This morning, sitting in front of the lights, Colin said that he felt it must be significant that the bright light group were up before the dim light group. I hope he is right. So, Here we are. 19th of July. Obviously the sun was beginning to come back again. Yes, realised today that the sun is coming back and got quite excited. It seemed quite bright, but that's just because it has been so dark. Our cameras still think it's dark. Amazed that I can't. 31st of July. I don't seem to be able to. You'd have thought I'd have written a great big thing, Sun Comes Back Today or something. But ah, here we are. Saturday, the 11th of August. Sun up today, and so a day off in celebration. Not that we saw the sun. It's been manky. That's a fid word for a really sort of grey, miserable day, for ages now. Broke the old flag out. We don't seem to. No one seems to have supplied us with a new one, even though that's what we're here for. Some champagne was opened. We had a lazy day. It's nice to have a two-day weekend on a Saturday when you don't have to work or don't have to feel you've got to work. So many other things to do. Yes. Been glorious weather. Clear, calm and cold, but now it's blowing 30 knots. Yeah. Sorry, I don't seem. I obviously didn't. The day the sun came up obviously wasn't quite as good as I remember, probably. Sun setting on the clouds was a superb magenta hue to the whole sky, quite beautiful. Yes, that's one thing that I did remember very vividly, actually, was the colours in the sky. They were sort of pastel colours that were just... I don't know if you've seen any of Edward Wilson's watercolours of the Antarctic that he did when he was down there with Captain Scott. And he's got the colours absolutely right, and I don't think any photograph... Well, certainly no photograph that I've ever seen quite captures the subtle colours that he was able to capture in his watercolours that are just there. It's just they're just different from anywhere else that I've ever seen.
They're like pastel?
Yes, pastel colours. I don't know. Do you understand what that? Yes. Yeah. Very sort of subtle and.
Find them out there or here?
No, you don't tend to see them, or if you do, they're only here, when you see them here, they're only there for a very short time because the sun is rising and setting much more quickly in at this latitude than it is where in the Antarctic, where you know the sun is very low for a long period, and so you tend to see the colours on the clouds reflect. I think there's also a lot of reflected colour from the ice, which gets reflected up onto this cloud somehow, and you get these lovely colours.
What kind of context did you have with the outside world?
We had on the base there was a fax machine, and we got faxes every day from Cambridge. So we had contact with Cambridge every day for official business, and we had some contact with our friends and families at home. We got 200 words a month on the fax machine, which was free, and we could pay for more if we wanted. There was also a telephone which we could use if we wanted to, but it was very expensive. And a lot of people, when they came down to the Antarctic, came down there almost in a way to get away from civilization, if you like. And I certainly felt that, I'd gone down there partly because it was exciting to be completely isolated and not have to be phoning home all the time. And I, my parents and friends didn't actually know that there was a telephone that we could have phoned them from. Whether they would have been upset had they known that that I hadn't phoned, I don't know. But so there was that contact. I'm very keen on keeping up to date with what's going on in the world, and so I used to listen to the BBC World Service. We had a big shortwave receiver, which was part of the communications equipment. And I used to tune into the BBC World Service every evening to listen to the world news. And I used to transcribe the main headlines of the news so that anyone who wanted to on the base could keep up with what was going on in the world. One or two people weren't at all interested. They really just wanted to... they didn't want to know what was going on in the world. But it was the year of the miners' strike, and it was all very... the news from England was all fairly depressing, and I think we all felt that we were sort of quite well out of it. and apart from that, we were in contact with the other British bases, and then the radio officer was in contact with some of the other bases in the Antarctic, collecting and collating weather information. And he used to speak to, I think, the Indians and the Germans and I'm not sure. Oh, the Russians we used to have fairly. So those were the sort of the radio links we had. And then in the summer we had a visit from the British Antarctic Survey aeroplanes. Some officials from headquarters came and visited during the relief period, and we also had a visit from the German aircraft. On its the German aircraft came and refueled before going on to its own base. We in the summer we had a visit from the German research ship, who brought fuel for the German aircraft. So that was quite exciting. And we also had a visit from a Russian ship that was laying a depot of fuel for Russian aircraft. And they brought us fresh fruit and vegetables, which was a welcome relief after, 12 months without, certainly 11 months without fresh fruit and vegetables. So that was good.
How did you get on with the Russians?
I hardly met them actually, but everyone was very friendly. Everyone was very friendly, and there was no problems at all. They came round, and we gave them some good food, and they gave us some fruit and vegetables, and they took away some magazines from the base and left us with some vodka. And some people went onto their ship. No, it was all very... Everyone was very friendly. There was no animosity or anything. It was good.
What kind of messages do you send home when you only have 200 words?
brief messages. Now, somewhere... I don't know where they are. Somewhere I've probably got them. Well, certainly some of them. Oh, no, I know where they are. My mother's kept them all. My mother's got them all at home in a file. But what sort of thing? Well, I mean, you know, I used to tell them sort of things that I was doing, and you know, whether we were going off visiting the penguin colony or whether people were upset or. I honestly can't remember exactly what I was writing about. I mean, it was always great to hear what people were doing at home, but of course, with 200 words, you cut out all the sort of emotional aspects of what was going on, and you can't really, in order to get as much information across in the minimum amount of words, you cut out quite a lot of the sort of interesting bits, but you tell people the news but not the background behind it, really. And my father was very good at, he wrote a letter every month, knowing that I wasn't going to get it, but every month he wrote a letter to me telling me what had gone on in that month, so that when the ship arrived after a year away, I had 12 letters from him, which I was able to open in, you know, I'd open January and then February and whatever. And it was nice to get sort of background news. The other thing I did was I made a tape, a bit like you're doing at the moment, but a tape. I had a tape recorder and I made a letter tape that I sent home. I sent one home just before the ship left, when we were staying there, and then when the ship came back I sent another one off, so that people heard my voice, and then that was sent home and recorded and sent off to various, sent round all the family and friends. So that was one way we communicated.
How much did you get to see of the country?
Well, Halley is now a fixed base. I just want to put a jump. In the 1960s, Halley was a travelling base, and they did a lot of travelling to the transantarctic mountains. When I was there, it was a geophysical base, and it was basically looking at the ionosphere and the magnetosphere and things and the weather, the meteorology. So it was a fixed base. I mean, we didn't do a lot of travelling, but we all except one of us spent quite a lot of time at the penguin colony, which was about 10 miles away, which was a journey that you could do in a day. I mean, easily on a skidoo you could very easily get there and back. So when the weather was good we would go off down there. Some of us would spend some time camping down at the penguin colony because it was the place to go. There was something of interest there. There was another place which was full of sort of crevasses, and it was an interesting place to go, called, well, it was nicknamed Gin Bottle. I can't remember the name of the place. I have got it written down somewhere. No, I've got a map. And we would go down there. What was it called? No, here are Gin Bottle. Can't remember what it was actually called. We'd go down there because it was very interesting. And one day when we were there, there were four of us down there, and we were camping. And there was an awful lot of noise going on in the ice, as if the ice was moving. And I suppose the nearest I can get to it is it must have been like what it's like to be in an earthquake. And we were just walking about on the on the ice, thinking that not the sea ice, on the ice cliffs, and suddenly the noise began to get worse and worse and worse, and then we looked up and there were some icebergs actually breaking off the edge of the cliff, and we felt very, very small and very vulnerable, and we ran back to where we thought was a much safer place, a bit further in from the edge of the ice cliffs. But it was absolutely fascinating to see these icebergs breaking off the edge of the ice cliff. And had we been perhaps half an hour earlier in leaving, in fact we'd been doing the washing up after breakfast, and had we not done the washing up and we'd just gone straight out, I think we would be we may well have been on one of these icebergs and may not be here today to talk. But so we called the new bay that was formed from these icebergs breaking off, we called it Washing Up Bay, which was just a thing between us on the bay, so it was nothing special. But that was very frightening and something that I wouldn't recommend, wouldn't want to experience again, really. So there was that. So we visited that area, and then during the year, we each had 2 weeks where we were allowed to have time off from our work, and we went off travelling as a group of four, and everyone made a journey. And we went to a place called Christmas Box Hill, which had first been discovered on Boxing Day in the 50s or 60s. And we were I think we were the next people to go there. And that was, I think, about 200 miles from base. Other people went to what was called the Hinge Zone, basically, people went travelling with skidoos and tents and sledges to get away from the base and to have a bit of a sort of experience of what it must have been like for Scott and Amundsen and people to... I mean, I think we had very much better equipment than they did. Very much better equipment. and much better food, of course, too. So that was that. They were all. That was all quite exciting. The travelling.
Look this up in your diary.
Look up what.
The trip.
Christmas books. Oh, yeah. Now, yes, we... We were... going... We were going to go... on the 15th of November, I think. No, we're going to go on the 16th of November, which was a Friday, but there was a blizzard, and the blizzard went on for 7 days, and we in fact left on the 23rd of November. And I obviously took another notebook with me, and it says here, transcribed from notebook. So, beautiful sunny morning, 12 to 15 knots of wind, leave just after 8 a.m. Lovely soft surface after the blow, and there are few sastrugi. Drive across the Bondu, that's just the surface of the snow, for what seems like forever. N9, that was a depot, by 11 a.m. to refuel and raise the dump. every time you came all over the Antarctic, there are dumps of fuel and food, and they tend to get buried. They're marked with a flag. They tend to get buried, and so every time you come across one, you raise it up onto the surface again and make sure that everything's there. So 12 hours driving, arrive at the Stancomb Wills Glacier, find a seal colony with pups of Weddell seals, covered 73 miles. That was the first day. Day two, up at 7 a.m. after an intermittent night's sleep. Da, 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 da. Yes. The water didn't freeze last night, and we could spread the butter. What a change from when it was. Yes, well, I camped down at the penguin colony during midwinter, and what a change from when it was minus 30 degrees C camping. So that was pretty cold, minus 30 degrees C. So first camp was at the Stancomb Wills. Second camp was on the Stancomb Wills, further 46 miles, so we travelled 134 miles from base. Yeah, so we then went in or beside, it says the Grand Canal, 61 miles from camp one. So by day three, right, day four, we were arriving near Christmas Box Hill. But each time we tried to strike out, we were foiled by thin sea ice or actual narrow leads. So we couldn't get the skidoos actually across to Christmas Box Hill, which was a bit frustrating, really. But day five. So it must have been, it's amazing how you don't remember, but it must have been about 150 miles from base that we went, not 200 miles. So, and then day six, day seven, day eight, day 11. A beautiful day. Pack up quite quickly and get back to the base. As we went, when we returned home via the penguin colony and had a time down on the penguin colony.
Hmm. When do you consider a place interesting on Antarctica?
Sorry, do I find it interesting?
No, you said some time ago, you said there you go to a place of interest.
Right. Well, yes, I mean, you may find it difficult to imagine, but where Halley is built is completely flat, and it's white, and it's just ice, completely flat for hundreds of miles. So a place of interest is where it's something different. Either there's crevasses, or there's a glacier, or there's a penguin colony, or there's a change in terrain. And Christmas Box Hill, for instance, is a hill that is something that you don't see around Halley at all. So you have to travel sort of 100 miles to see a hill. So that was, you know, and I suppose anywhere that's away from the base is slightly different, slightly more interesting. It's interesting because it's different, I think, really. And one of the most amazing experiences I had when I was down there was I just went skiing for a morning, and I went skiing out to the east of the base, and the wind always comes from the east at Halley, and I skied out into the wind, and there was only a very, very, very small amount of wind, and I just skied out and I stopped, and I couldn't hear a thing. There was absolutely no sound going on at all, because the very, very gentle wind was taking all the noises of the base away from me. And there were no aeroplanes, there were no cars, there were no birds, there were no animals. The wind wasn't rustling in any vegetation. And it was completely silent. And it was a really, a very sort of eerie feeling that you could just hear yourself. That was the only thing that was there that you could hear, and that was a very moving experience.
How long did you stay there?
At that particular point, I don't know, half an hour or so. I sort of stopped, I suppose, until I got cold, and then I started skiing again to warm up. I mean, it may have been 10 minutes or something like that, but it wasn't a long time. I'm sure I wrote something down about it in my diary, but it would take me a long time to find it because I can't remember which part of the year it was.
You told me about the on the phone. You told me about the sense of isolation and the fact that you were. When you were in the base, you were making up your mind about what to do.
Oh, what to do when I came? Yes.
Come back.
Oh, well, if the ship didn't come back, yes. Yes, that was funny, really, wasn't it? I mean, I suppose I'd really like to read what I wrote about. I must have written something about it somewhere, but I think we all had this sort of little nagging feeling in the back of our minds, and I'm sure it was really only in the back of our minds, that suppose there was some catastrophe in the civilized world, that where the ship was coming from, and suppose the ship wasn't able to come back, or suppose the ship had had some disaster had happened to the ship on the way down to us. We'd have been stranded. We'd certainly been stranded for some time. And I suppose we wondered what would happen to us. I suppose one of the things that struck me was, you know, suppose there was a nuclear war, and the Western civilization was sort of wiped out. I mean, it would have been unlikely that we would have been affected by that, certainly in the short term, and we might have been able to have got back to somewhere where we would have been able to survive. And we sort of thought about laying depots, and if we had to, we could have almost certainly have managed to get in contact with the other bases in the Antarctic, and we could have travelled across to the Antarctic Peninsula. And I'm sure, having got to the Antarctic Peninsula, I'm sure that you've spoken to Ray Ady and people, they've travelled from Hope Bay down to, you know, right the way down the peninsula, and so it would have been possible to have travelled all the way back up to Hope Bay, and from then, I mean, we know that Shackleton was able to go from where he was stranded in the Weddell Sea to Elephant Island, and thence to South Georgia. I'm sure we would have been able to have done the same had we have got hold of some boats or built some boats or whatever. So I suppose we were sort of trying to relive one of the sort of heroic ages of the Antarctic exploration. I mean, Shackleton and people Shackleton's boat journey is one of those fantastic stories of Antarctic exploration, and perhaps we were all secretly hoping that we would be able to have a similar experience. I don't think any of us would have enjoyed it, and none of us would have wished it on anybody, but it would have been.
It was like what you told about this journey to Christmas Box Hill, like it's also sort of reliving.
Yeah, I suppose it would have been, yes.
How close do you think you can get
to reliving that sort of thing? Well, I think, I mean, you know, you can't, with modern equipment, I mean, you know, no one would set off now on an expedition with the sort of equipment that people used in the heroic ages, and we've got much better equipment, and we understand a bit more about the food and the vitamins that are required, and we understand much more about all sorts of things. So we can't go back to the past and relive, you know, that experience. And who would want to? If you can live in a tent in the Antarctic much more comfortably than Scott managed, then that's the sort of thing you should do. So we did. We had, we lived very comfortably in our tents. It was warm, and we were able to dry our clothes out overnight, and none of us, fortunately, suffered from frostbite or I think all of us suffered from frost nip. That's the sort of early bits of frostbite, especially on sort of extremities. I frost nip my face and my fingers, and other people frost nip their ears and their nose, you know. But you can't go back to the past. You've got to carry on living in the present and using the equipment that's available. And
No, you don't go out to relive this kind of hardship.
No.
But you also didn't stay home, of course.
Didn't stay at home? No, no, no.
You
didn't stay in
England.
No,
it was still winter.
Right. Why did I go? I don't know why I went.
No. What do you think about the sort of human condition of this continent? I mean, is it within reach to almost to live there in a normal way?
No, it's not. No, because I mean, we had a very, very comfortable existence, but at relatively huge expense. I mean, everything has to be transported down there, everything has to be transported back. I mean, there's nothing there. Certainly where we were, there was absolutely nothing there except ice for hundreds of miles. So everything has to be imported into the place. So you couldn't, certainly not where we were, you couldn't set up, I don't think anywhere, you could set up a proper community that's viable. And I don't think I would want to see it. It's such an amazing continent. I'd like to see it preserved and, okay, explored, and people, I don't want to be selfish and say, you know, no one can go there because I've been there, why shouldn't other people go there? But I think that we have to be very careful about how we allow it to be explored and exploited, because it is such a special place, and let's try and keep it as such a special place. There aren't many places in the world that are so special.
Do you have a best day? I probably asked you on the telephone about sort of
the best day.
Yeah, sort of highlight experience that stands out.
Well, no, I can't. I mean, there were days that were. Yes. No, there's nothing that. I mean, funnily enough, the human mind is such that it tends to remember the good things and tends to forget the unpleasant things and the bad things. And I suppose one of the good days was the day the ship came back. I mean, everyone was excited about being there, about going there, but people were also excited about going home. No, I was just thinking that one of the days, one of the best days might have been the day that the ship came back, but I haven't written down here, you know, what a fantastic day. No, I don't know. I don't think there was any particularly special day. I know that the day we left, the day I joined the ship to go home, I thought to myself, you know, it was a funny day, you know. I didn't really feel any emotion about leaving the place. I didn't feel sad. I didn't feel happy. We just left. And that seems strange in a way that, you know, there we'd spent so long, you know, a whole year there, and yet there wasn't sort of any sadness about leaving. I don't even mention that actually, no, in my diary.
How did you explain that afterwards?
How did I explain the fact that I didn't feel any emotion about leaving the place? I don't know. I've never really been able to explain it actually. I mean, it wasn't because I wanted to forget it. I mean, after all, I wouldn't be talking to you now if I'd wanted to forget it, because if I'd wanted to forget it, I'd have just put everything out of my mind. I'd have probably thrown this diary away, and I wouldn't have been excited about talking about it. You know, I've given lots and lots of talks. I've got 1,000 slides. You know, and I'm excited about the place, and I'm still a member of the Bass Club and all the rest of it. And I'd love to go back. I mean, I'd love to go back to visit. I don't want to stay. I don't want to stay there. I don't want to spoil the illusion that I've got of it being a, you know, that year that I had down there with those people, I remember as being great fun, a good time, something that I enjoyed. And I don't want to go back there and spend another year there, because I'm sure I would be trying to relive the experiences that I had with the people that were there, and that it wouldn't happen. It would be different. And but I would like to go back and visit. There's no doubt about that. I would like to go back and visit. I'd like to go back and just see what's happened to our base. I'd like to go back and visit the penguin colony again. But something that probably won't happen unless the survey invite me to be a summer doctor for a couple of months or something, and I happen to be able to take some time off or whatever. I think, you know, it's got to be. I've got to just remember it for what it is and what I did.
Do you think I forgot to bring up something, some topic or so that you thought would relate to?
It's quite difficult. I mean, you know, you're. I think I gather you're trying to get some sort of feel of the human element of yeah, that's right. And I'm terribly busy at the moment, and I just haven't had a time, for instance, to read this diary again. And if I had some time, maybe I could bring some more things out if I read my diary. I mean, I haven't read my diary because I haven't felt the need to, and I haven't, in some ways, I haven't wanted to explore how I actually felt. Maybe, you know, maybe now 10 years on, well, nearly 10 years on, it's the time to start thinking about, you know, looking at it, and maybe it would be exciting. There we are.
There we are.
Yeah.
All right.